Good Monday morning to you. It's December 4th. The snow's out there. I'm Renee Bodley here with my co-host Doug Wells, who's back from assignment. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning. Not only is the snow out there, but we've got blue skies.
It looks gorgeous out there. I know all the skiers are excited. We needed this.
We did. You know, there was I went out this weekend, and the resorts have done a great job making snow, but there sure was a lot of brown on the hill still, and hopefully this helps them out quite a bit.
Kind of eerie seeing all that brown out there.
It was weird. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So before we get into all of today's business news and some exciting guests, we want to give you a traffic alert. Traffic is backed up on Interstate 80 coming into Park City. It's backed up all the way to Jeremy Ranch, and we understand that's due to an accident on 224 between Kimball Junction and Bear Hollow. So if you're trying to get into Park City from Interstate 80, you're going to have a tough time. There's an accident there between Kimball Junction and Bear Hollow on 224. We don't know how serious that accident is, but
the traffic's backed up all the way to Jeremy Ranch, they might want to go around over to and come in 248.
One would think. However, Leslie Thatcher just handed me this info, and she said 248 is backed up all the way to US 40. So we're clogged on both ends getting into town. So wherever you're going, give yourself that extra time and make sure you keep that distance between you and the car in front of you.
Yeah, call your boss. Tell them you're going to be late. They understand. They know there's only two roads into this town, and you're going to be late, and that's just a reality. No need to drive stressfully or aggressively.
Yeah, take time, enjoy the blue sky and the snow, and you will eventually get to where you're going and safely, we hope. We'll give you updates on that throughout the hour. And coming up this hour, we are going to talk to our first guest. He's Derek Miller, the president and chief executive officer of the World Trade Center of Utah. And that's an interesting organization, Doug. So we'll find out what the World Trade Center Utah does for companies here. I also recently listened to an interview that he did with Utah Policy where he talked about the Trump administration and some positives and negatives that he sees for Utah companies when it comes to Trump's trade policies. And, of course, we'll talk to him about their recent trip to the Middle East.
That'll be an interesting conversation. Our second guest is going to be John Mitchell. They are with he's a transportation futurist with a company called Skyworks Global. And we're all waiting for our flying cars. I guess we're just going to bypass the flying car for ourselves and go right into flying taxi cabs. So John is going to talk to us about that. And then our final guest is Claudia McMullen. Most of us know her here in town. She runs Hugo's Coffee Roasters, and she's going to come in and tell us what's going on at Hugo's. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays!
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley here with Doug Wells. Our first guest this morning is Derek Miller, President and Chief Executive Officer of World Trade Center Utah. And let's give our listeners a little bit of background before we get Derek on the line. Utah saw a 3% increase in international trade year to year this past year. And Utah sees somewhere north of $12 billion in exports. That's $12 billion with a B. And we are the sixth fastest growing export economy in the country. And joining us on the phone right now to tell us what this means for your wallet is Derek Miller. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee. How are you doing on this snowy Monday morning?
Well, the sun is shining up here and it's snowy. Is the sun out in Salt Lake City?
It's starting to. I'm seeing a break in the clouds. We woke up to a few inches, probably not as much as you got in Park City, but down here in the valley, we've got a few inches and we're starting to see some blue sky.
Well, nice. We're happy to have you as a weather reporter as well as a trade expert. Let's start with our first question. What does the World Trade Center Utah do?
Great question. People are often surprised to find out that we have a World Trade Center in Utah. And, of course, we're part of the global World Trade Center network. We're most famously headquartered, of course, in New York City in one World Trade Tower. But as I said, people are surprised to find out that there are actually over 300 World Trade Centers, of course, all over the world in over 100 different countries. And in Utah, we act as a private nonprofit where we really focus on helping Utah companies to increase their international business and make more here in Utah and sell more around the world.
And you recently went to the Middle East, Jordan and Israel. Why did you pick that area?
Well, one of the things that we do in order to accomplish our mission at the World Trade Center is to take these trade missions. We also help companies go on trade shows. And the purpose of every trade mission is really to connect Utah businesses with opportunities to sell more, to provide more services overseas. And in Israel and Jordan in particular, Israel is an area we had been to before. We went on a trade mission there about 4 years ago. We were very well received. We built a lot of connections over those intervening 4 years. And then we also wanted to go to Jordan because Utah has a lot of strong academic connections to Jordan, and we thought there would be an opportunity to build on those university connections and build more business connections. They've got a thriving and growing entrepreneurial culture and ecosystem in Jordan, and sure enough, we found that to be true.
Yeah, Jordan's got a thriving entrepreneurial ecosystem, and people might be surprised. Israel is one of the tech leaders in the world, really. It's certainly not a Silicon Valley, but it's a close second or third to Silicon Valley. Give us some examples of the type of trade that Utah does with Jordan and with Israel.
Well, let's start with Israel first, Doug, because you've already hit the nail on the head with regard to the tech sector. And in many ways, Utah and Israel are similar. I mean, it's not just the fact that we both got a Jordan River and a Dead Sea and a Zion. In this case, it's Zion's Bank and Zion's National Park in Utah. We've got a Mount Nebo and among other things. But besides the geography, there was really a similarity in culture as to Israel was not blessed with a lot of natural resources, so the people had to figure out what they were going to do to build their economy. Utah, similar, a high mountain desert. People came here in 1847 and had to figure out what they were going to do to build their economy. Specifically in the tech sector, the biomedical sector, there's a very cool company. You may have heard about it. It was born out of the University of Utah Medical School. Called Peel Therapeutics. Peel is Israeli name for elephant. And this is a study that they've been doing out of the University of Utah where they found that elephants don't get cancer. Who knew? But sure enough, elephants, even though they grow very large and they have a lot of cellular mass, they don't get cancer. And so these doctors out of the University of Utah, specifically Dr. Josh Schiffman, was looking at why. Why is it that elephants don't get cancer? And they found this element within elephants that fights cancer when it starts. And so they've partnered with a group out of Israel, another university in Israel, Dr. Ari Fleischer, and they found a way to deliver this enzyme from elephants to starting to do human testing, but they've been testing in mice, and sure enough, they found that when they introduce those cancer-fighting enzymes into the mice, it also attacks and kills cancerous growth. So something that could be revolutionary, another great Utah-Israeli connection.
And there's another company we're familiar with up here in Park City, Intermountain Healthcare. They've got a hospital up here, and they went along with you on the trade mission. What interest do they have in Jordan and Israel?
Yeah, Intermountain Healthcare actually came with us about when we went 4 years ago, and they started looking at companies that they could invest in, as you'd imagine, medical companies that they could invest in. And they found an organization that they were able to make an investment in. Peel Therapeutics is the name of it. And what Peel Therapeutics does is it is able to use this concept of big data and look at imaging. And instead of having to have doctors and nurses look at every image, they're able to automate a lot of that. And so with whatever kind of scan you're getting, they can do artificial intelligence to do an initial review of that scan and start to figure out what it's seeing and then provide that analyzed information to the doctor, who gives them an opportunity, him or her, to make a more informed decision. So another great partnership between a Utah company and a company there in Israel.
Derek, a key part of the visit was a visit to the port of Ashdod, where you were looking at what the impact was on the local economy there. Why was that something your group was interested in? I know I've heard talk about the inland port here in Utah. Was it related to that or something different?
Well, it was a couple things, and one was certainly the inland port. As you mentioned, Doug, we're looking at the real possibility of building an inland port in Utah. Of course, we've long been known as the crossroads of the West. That was true in pioneer times. It was true when they built the Intercontinental Railroad, the Transcontinental Telegraph Line. Of course, our major east-west, north-south freeway systems in the United States meet up in Utah. And for all of those reasons, Utah is the real logistics hub for the western U.S. The opportunity to build an inland port is actually to take that existing infrastructure we already have and enhance it in a way that we would be able to do a lot of containerization work, a lot of customs work, and most importantly for our economy, a lot of last-line manufacturing that happens at inland ports. Think about the Long Beach port. These ports are in the business to continue to be in business, to grow, but they're constrained. They don't have any more extra space to grow in, so they can only grow in one of two ways. One is automation, which they're currently doing. The second way they can grow is by looking at opportunities like an inland port in Utah. So we wanted to go see what they were doing at the port of Ashdod to see how that could inform the decision that we're trying to make in Utah. But the second reason that we went there is, again, another great partnership between Israel and Utah, is that there's a Utah company called Global Sim. Sim, of course, standing for simulator or simulation. This is a Utah company that is the world leader in providing simulation equipment, not just for ports, but in a lot of different areas, but particularly at the port of Ashdod. All of the training that is done, you can imagine how important it is to have well-trained employees at a port who are both from a safety standpoint as well as an efficiency standpoint, who are using this multi-million dollar, very large, if not done correctly, can be very dangerous equipment. So they will train all their employees on these simulators before they actually get out in the port and start working these huge cranes. And all of that simulation is done on Utah equipment.
Derek, I've got a two-part question for you in regards to your recent trip to the Middle East. You wrote, I guess, an editorial in the Deseret News that said, "Lessons of Thanksgiving from the Kingdom of Jordan." And you talked about the similarities between Utah and Jordan that you mentioned at the start of the interview, the geographic similarities. But then you also talked about sharing the same values of caring and compassion. And you specifically mentioned the refugee crisis in Jordan and drew some analogies to Utah. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. We were really grateful for the opportunity on the business side to be able to go to Jordan, but we discovered something that was a little bit of a surprise to us, and that is just how similar our cultures and our values are between Jordan and Utah, and as you mentioned, Renee, specifically to this point of refugees, think about this for just a second. You've got the country of Jordan. I mean, we talked about Utah being the crossroads of the West. Here's a country that's been the crossroads of the Middle East for millennia, and so whatever the kingdom or ruler or country was, I mean, they are just a country that has been surrounded by chaos, for lack of a better word, for a long, long time. And most recently, you've got Syria, of course, the horrible civil war that's happening there to their north. And then you've got a lot of economic turmoil that's happening in Egypt to their south. And so because of that, and because of the relative stability in Jordan and the relative strong economy in Jordan, many of these refugees from Egypt, from Syria, are going to Jordan. And in fact, to the tune of over a million people. Now, that represents more than 10% of their population. And so you can imagine the great challenge it is to incorporate, to welcome, to assimilate over 10% of a population growth in the course of just a few months. And they are just doing a remarkable job under very difficult circumstances in Jordan. And, of course, the similarity in Utah is while we're certainly not bringing in 10% of refugees to Utah, but we are a welcoming state. In fact, we were the only state with a Republican governor that did not sign on to this letter saying that they would not welcome Syrian refugees. In fact, our governor, Governor Herbert, said, "I'm the governor of a state that was founded by religious refugees, and our state will continue to be a state that welcomes refugees."
To what extent does World Trade Center Utah factor in the values, morals, and even ethics of a foreign country when it comes to encouraging businesses to invest in that country?
Well, we tell companies all the time here in Utah that they need to understand the culture of the country. That is one of the important things that they need to understand before they go over there and do business. And, of course, the culture includes the morals, the ethics, and everything else. And that's a big component. In fact, one of the things that we do at the World Trade Center Utah is host seminars, business seminars. And just one that we had a few months ago was on this idea of how do you translate a culture? And it's more than just translating words. It's translating those morals and those ethics.
Yeah, you were talking about Governor Herbert earlier, and I think it took a lot of courage actually for him as a Republican governor to say, yes, we're going to remain welcoming of refugees. And that was a great thing. What was his role in this tour? You know, that was a big use of the governor's time. Why was it important that he go?
Well, you're right, Doug. I mean, a governor's schedule, I served, as you may know, as the governor's chief of staff for several years. And so I understand with acuteness just how demanding that time schedule is. And so the fact that he would take, you know, 7 days, a full business week to go and to travel, you know, thousands of miles is a real dedication on the governor's part. And specifically what he's dedicated to is helping Utah businesses. So the governor calls himself all the time the CBO of Utah, the chief bragging officer of Utah. And it is really true. Wherever we go, whether it's going to Israel or Jordan or Vietnam or Singapore or Mexico or Canada, or even going to Silicon Valley, as we were just a couple weeks ago, meeting with a number of Taiwanese-owned businesses, the governor is always extolling Utah, our culture here, our business climate here. And he tells us all the time, look, there's only one reason we go on these trade missions, and that is to help Utah businesses, to help them succeed, to help them to grow. In fact, I'll just share on a personal note, just because I worked with the governor for several years, he really is a homebody. I mean, at the end of the day, he's not that so interested in traveling thousands of miles. He'd much rather go home at the end of the day to the governor's mansion and eat a bowl of Cheerios while he walks.
He's a smart man. There's a lot to be said for that.
question, if we can, to transition to President Trump and the Trump administration.
Yeah.
The TPP, we pulled out of that. Donald Trump campaigned against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He said it was a bad deal and worse than NAFTA. And you've said that Utah would have been a big winner in the TPP as far as international exports go. How big of a hit did we take?
Well, it's hard to quantify it, Renee, just because, you know, it's hard to know what a lost opportunity, how big a lost opportunity is. But it certainly was a lost opportunity. The Trans-Pacific Partnership included 11 other countries besides the United States. It had been negotiated over several years. The 11 other countries besides the U.S. that were included were in Southeast Asia. These are some of the fastest growing, largest emerging economies in the world. It also included parts of Central America, including Chile and Colombia. These are large economies in their own right. And basically, you know, you think of most of Asia except for China, and that's an important element of it as well. The reason I say that is because there's the trade aspect of it, but there's also the geopolitical aspect of it. These countries, they want to do business with the U.S. They want to be turned into the sphere of influence of the U.S. In fact, when we were in Vietnam this fall, it was interesting to me. Every single Vietnamese person we met with, this was all the way from government leaders to business leaders, all the way to our taxi cab drivers. When they found out that we were from the U.S., they would say, why doesn't the U.S. want to be our friend? We want to be your friend. We want to do business with you. We want to be aligned with the U.S. We don't want to be aligned with China. And yet my fear, both from a business standpoint, by pulling out of the TPP, as well as a geopolitical standpoint, is that we're pushing these countries into the arms of China. And in the short term and the long term, that will not be good for the interests of the United States.
Derek, let's talk some more about this. I think one of the things that critics of Trump would say is that we're giving up our leadership position in the world. And you're an expert of global world trade. Why is it so important that the United States maintain its leadership in these discussions? Why can't we just be a participant in the discussions?
Well, I think, you know, we stepped onto the world stage as a country, you know, in the early part of the 20th century and two world wars. And I think we did so reluctantly, but, you know, there was obviously a necessity. It wasn't just, you know, a business imperative. It was a moral imperative and a survival existential imperative that we do that. And so we took on that role, even if it was reluctantly. And it's not a role that we ought to easily give up, because there are values within this country. And it's not to say that they're exclusive to the United States, but there are values that relate to the individual, you know, individual freedom, personal responsibility. And we want to see that across the world. It doesn't mean we have to go, you know, force it on other countries. I think we have to be careful of that. We've seen the problems that it creates when we think we're going to go force democracy on other countries, but we certainly have an interest in seeing stability and human rights across the world, and that's an area that we ought to be involved in. You know, just on that note and tying it back to Israel, the last time we were in Israel, we had a great opportunity to meet with the late Shimon Peres, who at the time we met with him was 90 years old. He recently passed away, and when we met with President Peres, I was walking into this meeting, and the gentleman, the consul general who had been helping us on the trade mission, he tugged on my suit coat on my sleeve, and I turned around and looked at him, and he whispered to me while we were walking in the meeting. He said, "Derek, this would be like if you were going to meet with George Washington." I mean, it was just such a bold statement and really caught me by surprise, and he could see the surprise on my face. So he went on to explain. He said, you know, Shimon Peres, he helped to found our country. He fought in our War of Independence. He served in every ministerial capacity there is, including serving as prime minister twice. And now he serves as the venerable and venerated president of our country. He is the George Washington of Israel. And so you can imagine, with that introduction, I was highly attuned to what the George Washington of Israel would say. And he, one of the things he shared with us is he said, the key to lasting peace is economic prosperity. Now, you think about that in the context in which this man lived his life, probably thinking every day about peace and how to achieve peace. And his belief was the key to lasting peace is economic prosperity. I think that's the role that the U.S. can play, is to bring the stability that can lead to prosperity that ultimately and hopefully leads to peace.
Derek, that's a great note for us to end on. I love that analogy to the George Washington of Israel. That's a great story. Economic growth is important. We've been very pleased to have you as our guest. Our guest has been Derek Miller. He's the president and chief executive officer of the World Trade Center in Utah. Again, Derek, thank you for joining us.
Thanks to both of you.
Stay tuned to Mound Money. Up next, we have John Michel, who is a transportation futurist, and I teased it at the top of the hour as flying car, flying taxi. Stay tuned to find out more.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Camp House Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampHouseCoffee.com.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are proud supporters of KPCW. We provide up-to-date market information, and our recent market report can be found at bhhsutah.com. Our agents can provide context to these market statistics and can be reached at 649-7171.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. That was a great conversation with Derek Miller, President and Chief Executive Officer of the World Trade Center in Utah. On the phone with us now, we have John Michel. He is a transportation futurist.
Right here. Oh, there he goes.
And I'm sorry, we weren't sure we had him on the phone, but we do, good news, we do have him on the phone. Transportation futurist and executive director at Skyworks Global. John, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for letting me take part and share some thoughts with you this morning.
So, John, I know we just got you on the phone, so you probably didn't hear my tease. I teased this as we never got our flying cars, but we're soon going to get our flying taxis. These aren't exactly flying yellow taxi cabs in the skies. These are gyroplanes. Tell our audience what those are.
Absolutely. Well, a gyroplane, if you think about it, blends the best of a helicopter, which allows you to take off vertically and mitigate the need for a lot of infrastructure, with the best of a traditional airplane, which allows you to drive range, economy. So think of an airplane that has a rotor, except a lot of the complexity normally associated with that is removed. And so what you get is a solution that is very affordable, very scalable, and very, very flexible. So it provides an incredible amount of new opportunity in a technology that itself has been around for a very long time. And I like to tell people it's been the right technology waiting for the right time. And we believe the urban air taxi movement is exactly that time.
Yeah, you're right. I'm a flying buff. I fly small airplanes as a hobby. I've taken some helicopter lessons, and the gyroplane is a very cool invention that's been waiting for the right application. Now, here in town, John, we actually have a negative connotation with air taxis. We had Uber come into town during Sundance a couple years ago, and it was like an air assault from Uber. It was just one after the other after the other. So how do you address that? How do you address the what some people would call potentially a nuisance in the noise associated with air taxis?
No, I think that's a fair initial critique. The reality is one of the greatest benefits that's enabling this conversation to move to the next level that we all know is multiple advances in technology. So a lot of the noise has been associated with, again, some of the older type of technology applications. When you do things like add tipjet, or when you start to think about where this market's going to be in the next 5 years, which is full electrification. So, you know, the critics are out as far as, or the experts are out on whether it's 5 years or 7 years. But we see that the electrification movement is washing across the globe based on these massive investments. So what has historically been one of the sticking points, especially if you're going to operate in an urban environment, is this notion of noise. This is why you have a lot of limitations with helicopters. A lot of these are being mitigated, again, by the move to, first, what is hybrid. And hybrid means you've got these really cheap-like engines now. That, you know, you've got an engine that can do, it weighs 350 pounds of thrust for forward movement. So you get a lot of thrust, but you also get that at lower complexity and at lower noise. You blend that now with electrification to create a hybrid approach. You create not just a much more efficient, but a quieter solution. And the part about Uber, that's a different conversation in itself. I mean, just the way they operate, the advantage to Uber, I call them a blessing and a bane. They're a bane in that they've actually made many of our streets messier because they poured a lot of capacity in there. The blessing is they've helped people reconceptualize the entire mobility experience, both on the ground and in the air. And the fact that 22 different companies have been launched in the last 24 months, raising $500 billion or $500 million, tells you how much interest there is in this urban air taxi movement.
So your company is planning to start FAA certification, I guess, next year. What is the current feeling at the FAA? Are you thinking they're pretty progressive right now? When it comes to drones, they've made some pretty big steps forward. Are you optimistic they'll do the same with this new technology?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, we were just at a conference. It's put on in San Diego 3 days ago, Part of this is the president's mandate, right, to do for drone technology and these kind of unmanned systems to the incredible progressive view we've seen the Congress take on autonomous vehicle integration. Everyone recognizes this is a game changer. So if you take the gyrocraft elements of that, the advantages were second mover. And what I mean by that is there's a German company that plays in gyrocraft application at the sport level. They sell already up to an aircraft and a half a day. That's pretty significant just the last couple of years. And they were able to garner FAA certification already as of May of this last year. So already there's a growing acceptance, not just for all things manned or unmanned in the airspace. There's also, this has actually already occurred. So we'll be ushering a both manned and unmanned variant. And we're quite optimistic that, again, it goes back to my statement at the beginning. It's the right technology, and we believe now is the right time.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So, John, we're a business show, and so I want to talk about the business aspects of this. So you're in an industry where you're a first mover. You're going to do all the heavy lifting. Renee's question about the FAA was very insightful because you can't do anything without the FAA's approval on this. They tend to be a slow-moving organization. They have moved quickly in drones and in other cases. But there was a lot of public outcry for that. In this case, nobody's saying, hey, I'm waiting for my air taxi, other than you and your industry peers. So you're doing the heavy lifting now. What's the advantage to you of being the first mover in this industry, as opposed to the FAA approving it and saying, okay, we can do this, and somebody copying you 6 months later?
Absolutely. No, I think it's a great question. And again, a lot of this conversation, appropriately so, is focused on America. And so this is really, if we kind of, from a business application, this is what I call the new economics of mobility. Today we're talking specifically about this, you know, gyrocraft and how they fit within this urban air taxi dimension. The reality is we're seeing America now come to the realization that of all the things we inspire the world with, the nature of our transportation system from end to end is not an inspiring element. But we have an opportunity to reconceptualize that. You see all kinds of things going on the ground, so the reordering of transportation. And what Uber has really done has sparked the possibility that the end-to-end travel chain for consumers is possible with a tap of an app. You literally now, that integrated trip chain will take care of everything on the ground to even in some cases take your commute from 2 hours to 27 minutes. And the technology is going to enable the scalability of that. But we're actually, I believe, missing the bigger value proposition here. And that is, when you look at other than first world markets, so the FAA, as you astutely pointed out, becomes one of the, I'll just say, elements that constrains the rate at which this technology might make its way to market. Except that's not the case outside the United States. If you know from my background, I mean, what I've done is kind of complex mobility challenges around the world that happen to be in the Air Force, like building air forces in war zones and other things. And we know that two-thirds of the world today doesn't have access to affordable air transportation. The reason we are incredibly excited, and we're in conversations in Africa and India, all these markets that today, because they don't have some of the limitations, are waiting for this technology. And so first mover, because of our 40 patents, allows us to now get this to not just affect America's mobility solution, we're after changing the way people experience air mobility around the world, especially in other than first world countries.
And you recently announced a joint venture. Skyworks has teamed up with something called Switch Mobility. And if I understand it correctly, Switch Mobility is an app I can download, and then it will tell me, Renee, you can take an Uber from your house to this air taxi station. The air taxi will then take you from that point to another station where you can then take an autonomous vehicle to work. Is that right? You're integrating all sorts of different, a personalized commuter plan.
That's exactly right. Think about, so all Uber and Lyft did is they gave you a personal driver, that feel that everyone can have their personal driver, you pay for it. What's been going on in Europe, especially Northern Europe, for the last several years is this move towards an integrated mobility ecosystem where you as a consumer, Renee, you're going to come on and you're going to say, here are my preferences. I'm Renee. I like to travel this way and I like these things, bike share, car share. I'll take all of it. It then simply says, I want to go from A to B. The system will, in real time, organize every possible choice, customize it to you. And the only decision hopefully you're going to have to make that morning is, do I want to go fast or do I want to go cheap? And now you can extend that. So what between Switch and what we're doing at Skywork, it takes it to the next natural extension. People are talking a lot about the platforms right now. But the reality is it's about the economics. And the economics is you have to integrate it in an end-to-end sense of possibilities and make it very easy for consumers. And Switch is one of the first what we call mobility as a service application to be brought to America. And it's being actually, I can share with you that it is being unfolded in Nashville, Tennessee, starting in April. So already we're starting to see, this move from what's not been a traditionally well-thought or organized type of transportation system in America to leap over in areas to very, very progressive new solutions. And Switch represents a new platform for consumers to move anywhere they want, any way they want.
And just to stress that, the Switch app will launch in Nashville next year. What month?
It's going to launch in April.
Launch in April. And how did you pick Nashville?
It was part of so the organization that we're working with in bringing together Skyworks and Switch, as well as our Finnish partners who developed some of the core technology. This Demand Trans, the organization that was in this press release that is partnered with Skyworks, actually won the contract to help reinvent Nashville's transit and really mobility on demand. So there's three things they're doing. They're actually closing the gaps in first and last mile service, something people are trying to do in many places. Two, they're actually bringing lower cost options for people with mobility challenges, the disabled and the elderly, because that's a really, really expensive and difficult, expensive proposition and difficult problem. And last but not least, they wanted to see how we could integrate everything from bikes to cars to, and Switch will make its unveiling there. So it's such an incredibly exciting time in this mobility renaissance. And America, I believe, has an unprecedented opportunity to really show the world what the convergence of the right kind of design, the right kind of planning, and the right kind of technology can do to change the consumer experience.
Yeah, transportation is a very exciting space right now. And, it almost feels funny for me to say that because until 5 years ago, it really wasn't, right? I mean, when Ford came out with the modern car, that was a long time ago, the 1920s, somewhere around there. And there really hasn't been a ton of innovation in this space, and it's just so amazing how much is going on now. Now, John, your vision is a very, very large vision. You were talking earlier about your background. This is what I would call, or more correctly, Jim Collins would call a big, hairy, audacious goal, right? It doesn't get much bigger than this. So tell us about your background, and does it take a finance genius? Does it take a Thomas Edison or a Ford to come up with this, or this big vision? What does it take for somebody like yourself to be able to carry something like this out?
No, you're right. It's, this is definitely the BHAG of all, in some regards, BHAGs. But what you see is a little bit about my background, then I'll answer the question about what I believe it takes for people to succeed in this space. So just, I'm very, I've had a very fortunate background. Again, worked through the military. I flew airplanes, so I understand the aerodynamics of it. I was brought in consistently throughout my career to help underperforming organizations get back on track. I was involved in developing the plan for the state of North Dakota to integrate mixed families and unmanned vehicles, worked with state senators there. So I got very involved in that very early on. So I understand the autonomous piece of it. I was ultimately, I wrote the strategy for the Department of Defense for the post-war strategy for how we were going to make global mobility continue to work for us. And that's really just an amalgamation of blending commercial partners with organic capabilities in the military in rail and all its forms, right? So multimodal. And then ultimately I was asked to go to Afghanistan to, we had the $7 billion Afghan Air Force, which is the most complex, if you will, undertaking of its type. We have seven different aircraft types that were blended in an active war zone. And you're not just developing and flying airplanes, you're actually having to develop everything associated in terms of how do you train, how do you recruit, how do you sustain. So the life cycle of aviation, which is one of the reasons why it just is hard for these to sustain globally. So you put all that together. We're in the age now of a couple things. To succeed, you have to be very, very good at what I call, mass collaboration. comfortable in engaging people in an emotionally intelligent way to be able to make the design something you co-create. There is no one-size-fits-all. We know that in any business model. And here, there are so many different ways you could get there. So I found that you have to be highly collaborative. We also live in an age that is all about integration, right? You've got to be able to take all these varied forms and make them work. So you have those particular ideas have to be brought to bear. And then ultimately, it's about organization. How do you build a package around this that brings the right people with the right ideas, with the right set of solutions, to solve the right problem? So to me, this is really an issue of leadership. And leaders at all levels, you know, coming together to be able to work with and for people with a human-centered design. And today what we have in the realm of mobility, I would offer, is a set of tools that are unprecedented in history. Our imagination is the limit. But to your point, it's going to take folks now who can get the right people pointed in the right direction for the right reasons. And that's why I'm just, you know, kind of an uncommon background to now be thrust in the middle of kind of a public transit reinvention. And I'm incredibly grateful because, again, as you said also, it is very, very exciting. Oh, and by the way, this is a $1.5 trillion space that is being created. New money, new opportunity between now and 2030. So it's also very, very lucrative.
Well, we wish you all the best with that, preferably all over the world. I'm not so sure how much people are rooting here in Park City to see these gyroplanes. But it's a bold plan. And if my notes are right, John, you're also a general. So thank you for your service and thank you for your time this morning.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity to spend some time with you.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Up next is Claudia McMullen with Hugo's Coffee. Please stay tuned.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. It's Monday, December 4th, and the time is 9:49. I'm Renee Bodley here with my co-host Doug Wells. Before we get to our next guest, just want to give everyone a heads up about the traffic out there. I'm looking at the UDOT traffic app, and it shows one big fat red line on 248 getting into town. The good news is, well, it looks like a yellow line on I-80 coming into Kimball Junction. At the start of the hour, we had heard that there was a significant traffic backup on Interstate 80 coming into Park City. The traffic was backed up all the way to Jeremy Ranch, and that was due to an accident on 224 between Kimball Junction and Bear Hollow. And then you might think 248 would be the way to go to get around that if you're trying to get into town, and apparently 248 is still backed up all the way to US 40. So please be careful out there. The sun is out, and it looks like the snow is starting to melt from the roads, but that doesn't mean it's still not slick in some places. So please be careful. Take your time to get to where you are going, and make sure you allow plenty of space between you and that car in front of you, and everyone will get to where they need to go safely. So joining us now in studio, we have Claudia McMullen and John Lynn. They're with Hugo Coffee. Welcome, you guys. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks for having us.
How was your drive-in?
It was tough. It was backed up. It is clearing up, though. It was definitely clearing up by the time we got here. But we gave ourselves 45 minutes to get here, seeing what the traffic outside of Hugo looked like.
And Hugo at the visitor center,
yes,
right there at Kimball Junction. So
yeah,
how long
so
did
we
it
could
take
see
you?
The accident that happened around Bear Hollow.
So can we call you now for traffic
you
updates?
You bet. It's all
that.
Glass. I look out. I could see everything that's happening. John took 20 minutes to get off of, when he got off of I-80, just to get to Hugo, took 20 minutes.
Oh,
and it's about a block and a half.
Yeah, that's a bummer, isn't it? Well, the transportation futurist we just had on, maybe some of his ideas can
help. Maybe the gyroplanes don't sound so bad after all.
Maybe not. Yeah. So, Claudia, you grew this business in 2 years.
Yes.
You started with nothing 2 years ago. Tell us what you got now.
Well, 2 years ago, John and I created the brand Hugo Coffee Roasters. We did so in part because, well, I created the company Hugo Coffee Roasters because I wanted to control my own product, having owned a coffee shop for a couple years. And in the first year, I realized I wanted to either own or start a roasting company. So after a year in business in the coffee shop, I started the roasting company to supply myself. John was the head roaster for a company called Silver Bean, which sold to a company called Brogue. And once it was sold to Brogue, I grabbed John after about a month where he was at Brogue, and we created the brand Hugo Coffee Roasters. We intentionally and specifically created a limited number of blends that appeal to a broad palate. So that was one of the ways we were distinguishing ourselves. We don't have like 30 single origin roasts going at a time. We have our blends. They're consistent. They're beautiful, and they're very approachable and appealing to a wide audience.
Well, let's talk about that. I like to go to San Diego in the winter occasionally, every 4 or 6 weeks, just to thaw out a little bit. And the friend that I stay with when I'm down there, his passion is, believe it or not, coffee roasting, coffee bean roasting. And he talks about it as a science. He talks about it as an art. So, John, let's go to you and talk about what does it take to be a good coffee roaster? What are you looking to achieve?
Well, what it takes to be a good coffee roaster is being able to see the potential in the coffees that you're bringing in. So you buy a coffee and there's all these beautiful flavors in the coffee, or there could be terrible flavors in the coffee, and you need to decide before you roast it how you want to develop those flavors, what you want to bring out, what you want to mute. So when we're looking at a new sample of a new coffee that we're bringing in, we do a bunch of small batch sample roasts to see what the potential of the coffee could be. And then we find a nice place where we think the coffee's really shining. And so it's a delicate balance of, you know, art, you know, drinking your coffee and developing your palate and seeing what you like and bringing this beautiful coffee to life. But at the same time, it's science. And in the roasting process, you know, knowing where you're at with the caramelization of sugars and, you know, just how you want to present your coffee.
You know, listening to my friend in San Diego, I never had this appreciation, but now I compare a well-roasted cup of coffee, you know, coffee made with well-roasted beans, to a nice glass of wine. Mm-hmm. Is that an analogy that you think is fair and representative?
Oh, definitely. I would say there's more flavor potential in coffee than wine. There's so many different varietals of coffee out there, and there's so many more coffee-growing regions in the coffee belt around the equator than where you can produce great bottles of wine, or good grapes at least. There's a much broader spectrum of flavors you can get out of coffee than you can get out of wine.
Claudia, was this always your goal, to go from coffee shop to coffee roaster and actually providing roasted coffee products in stores like Whole Foods?
No. My goal was to get out of being an attorney. So the way I got out of being an attorney was when the opportunity presented itself to buy the equipment of a coffee shop. And I thought, well, that sounds super fun. So I did that.
And it been super
fun?
It
was really fun. So it's been challenging for sure, because for the coffee shop, I had to grow a business that had a little stigma to it, because the first coffee shop in there was kind of a disaster. It didn't work out very well. So when I bought the shop, I had to overcome the stigma, create a brand, drive traffic, and I did, and it's been largely really fun. My first year in that business, I thought, well, this is like having a dinner party every day. You know, I spend my days making people happy, which is a lot different from being an attorney or being a county counselor. So I make people happy, I give them good food and good coffee, and then the natural progression from that point was to get into the roasting business so that I could control my own product quality and control my own product and get wholesale accounts and blah, blah, blah. So you originally asked me how we changed from when we began. So when I was on this when we were on this program 2 years ago, I think our only customer was me, because my coffee shop was the first and biggest customer that we had for quite some time. And then we've slowly and consistently grown the business, gotten more customer base. We have hotels now. We have resorts. We have restaurants, coffee shops, lots of different places.
So is that the future of Hugo's Coffee, more on the providing a quality roasted bean, roasted product to others, or do you see yourself rolling out more coffee shops?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I have gone...
That's my job to
I
ask
have
interesting
gone
questions.
Back and forth on that, right? I've gone back and forth a number of times on that. The one thing about starting businesses is you have to be incredibly flexible and change with circumstances and take advantage of opportunities when they present themselves. So you think you have a growth strategy. And my growth strategy for a hot minute was, I'm going to open more coffee shops. And then you realize, that's really a pain. There's only one of me. I'm the face of the brand. I can't be that many places. So and retail's very difficult. So I thought of doing that. I've gone down the road of looking at other locations, and I've never pulled the trigger because it's not really where I want to go. I want to focus on growing the roasting business with wholesale accounts and selling on e-commerce. That's where I want to focus Hugo Coffee going forward, which is why I bought the equipment that I bought, which is the weigh-in fill machine. You need a weigh-in fill machine to do frack pack. So being able to frack pack is a big deal. To have high-quality coffee and an ability to frack means you can go into hotels, you can do banquets, you can do, you know, places that do high volume, and they just rip open a frack pack, and then they've got beautiful coffee. And so that machine was super important to get, and we acquired that in the past year. The other one was a nitro flush machine, hugely important if you want to go into Whole Foods or you want to go into Amazon, because you need to suck the oxygen out of the bag in order to elongate the shelf life of the product. So my product went from, we were like 2 to 4 weeks shelf life to 3 to 6 months.
We've got about 1 minute left. So share with our listeners what's been the biggest challenge in the past 2 years for you.
Oh, boy. The biggest challenge for sure is really adjusting to being flexible and changing your model to reflect reality, right? So when things don't work out, you try something else. I spent a year trying to get into a distribution company. When that didn't work out, I had to go somewhere else. I had to move my business plan to a different direction. And that flexibility is super important to be able to grow and to be able to grow in a sustainable way. And of course, also financing.
Well, flexibility, as you pointed out, it's a key metric to be successful in any business. It's a great story. You guys have made a lot of progress in the last 2 years. We wish you all the best going forward. Our guests have been Claudia McMullen, who runs Hugo Coffees, and John Lynn, who is the head coffee roaster there. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for KPCW comes from Park City Institute.
The blues will shake your soul when 5-time Grammy winner and Hall of Fame blues guitarist Robert Cray opens Park City Institute's 20th anniversary main stage season at the Eccles Center, Saturday, December 9th. Show starts at 7:30, tickets start at $29. Call the box office at 655-3114. Park City Institute is a nonprofit organization entertaining, educating, and illuminating since 1998.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mound Money, another fun show. Renee, thanks for joining me. Always interesting conversations. We also want to thank our great sponsors for Mound Money. They include Mountain West Bank, Vacasa, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Properties with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And thank you to our guests, Derek Miller, President and CEO of World Trade Center Utah, General John Michelle of Skyworks Global, he's a transportation futurist, and Claudia McMullen and John Lynn from Hugo Coffee. And we had to kind of rush them out the door. We were running out of time, but they just wanted us to remind our listeners, Hugo Coffee can be found at Park City Market, Whole Foods, Deer Valley Grocery, and on Amazon. They're being part of some 12 Days of Christmas on Amazon, Claudia said. I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, I'm not either, but it sounds like it might be a special, different special each day.
Yeah. Thank you, Doug. Thank you to our producer, Bob Hendricks. This is Mountain Money. You're listening to KPCW, Park City. NPR starts now.